on the devils together. I want to put it somehow in place in the arc of Dostoevsky's work. We know that The Idiot was published in 1869, and The Devils only 4 years after that, 1873. Think of the length of the novel, and it seems like a very short time in between those things. And both of those novels, as well as Crime and Punishment, and again, if you haven't read Crime and Punishment, you graduate students, hasten, go out there and read it on your own. You'll find it a bonbon after the enormous meals we've had in the novels in this class. And I'm teaching it right now for a sophomore class for the literary tradition course, and find, you know, just in contrast to The Idiot and The Devils, just how tightly put together it is, how much everything follows one thing after the other from one chapter to the next, how careful Dostoevsky was to tighten all the nuts and bolts, as we were just doing up here. And I think he felt freer after that, and felt that he could digress and explore more. And we have, in a sense, in The Idiot and in the Devils, perhaps an intellectually deeper works, but the kernel of just about everything that we're going to find in the three following great novels is all there in Crime and Punishment. All three of those novels really reflect on the action of the 1860s in Russia as well. And they all, just as did, in a sense, Turgenev's Fathers and Sons didn't quite have the perspective, didn't quite have the perch to do that, but actually almost became part of the history in that when Petersburg was burned, they said, that was your nihilists that did that to Turgenev. Turgenev presents to us in Bazarov a nihilist, but not really a nihilist. He's too noble, right? He's has too much of a sense of honor that is ingrained, although he won't confess it himself outwardly, and he dies quite nobly. So the spirit of the 1840s still remains in Turgenev. But those three great novels of Dostoevsky all reflect on the turbulent 1860s, and as we've suggested, the difference between the 1840s and the 1860s can be summed up quite briefly. In the 1840s, was still dominated by a kind of romantic idealism that Stepan Verkhovensky represents in our novel at hand, and the Russoistic, if we might want to say, belief that the human race is biddable. is perfectible, not only perfectible, but can be willingly led to such schemes of societal perfection. In the 1860s, the desire for that societal change had remained and intensified, but all beliefs in the nobility of human nature and idealistic schemes had disappeared, replaced by materialistic philosophies that had fully taken part in the revolt against Romanticism in the mid-19th century, and not without some insight, saw Romantic liberalism as a farrago of empty promises, and went on to create a nihilism that was truly without regard for human life, for nobility and spirit and all those other qualities of life of the human soul. To cite one instance, during the spring of 1862, there was a crest in the wave of this unrest in Petersburg in 1862 in mid-May, when a leaflet entitled Young Russia was circulated, and it brought one author writes that it brought the revolutionary ferment of the time to its convulsive climax. So So its author had entered the University of Moscow in 1859 and set up a clandestine printing press and published works by Herzen and Feuerbach, The Essence of Christianity, and Büchner, Stoff und Kraft, we all know the German title to that one, and Dostoevsky found a copy one morning in his apartment, found a copy wedged into the door handle of his apartment when he got up. And he wrote in his diary, which was, of course, a published diary, "One could not have imagined anything more nonsensical and stupid. Its contents were most shocking and expressed in a most ludicrous form, such as only a scoundrel could have invented. Young Russia," this pamphlet, "demanded, quote, a revolution, a bloody and pitiless revolution, a revolution which must change everything down to the very roots, utterly overthrowing all the foundations of present society and bringing about the ruin of all who support the present order. The leaflet demanded not only the expropriation of capital, but the total emancipation of women, the abolition of marriage as immoral, the suppression of the family as a barrier to the full development of the individual, the dissolution of convents and monasteries as, of course, centers of debauchery, and the secularization of all church property. The revolution, which, like so many others, Dostoevsky was convinced, was on the point of breaking out because of the peasantry's discontent with, with the terms of their recent liberation." Right, this is 1862, the emancipation had happened in 1861, and as always, where there's that sense that this isn't enough, we want more, and the floodgates will open. And this pamphlet was written to stoke that fire. In fact, fire was not just a metaphor. And at the same time, in that same month, a series of fires began to flame up in Petersburg, almost simultaneously with the pamphlet's circulation, and they raged for 2 weeks, doing a great deal of damage to Petersburg. And they broke out in various places at the same time, as if according to a prearranged plan. No one ever caught the persons responsible, and so there was plenty of blame to throw around. I mention all these things. Hang on just a second. Just to, you know, show what kind of realistic background, kind of newspaper background there was to the events that happened in the Devils. This was 11 years before this novel came out, and so rather than its being full of a kind of shocking and unbelievable violent climax, it's almost as though the reader might possibly expect such a thing, right? And that, I think, is important to keep in mind. We have in the novel, in a sense, although it is a terrible, terrible, violent, brutal climax, I don't know, there's a certain tone that keeps it from being, you know, like those moments, like the killing in Macbeth of
Duncan.
Of Duncan, or of is it Macduff's children? Or
yes,
Macduff's children. Macduff. Right, and those kind of terribly shocking moments that can happen in a Shakespearean tragedy. Shocked as we are, it seems to play out in a way that we already have a certain kind of remove from. So I think that's worth keeping in mind. I'll explain that. At least my view of it in a minute.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask you to post this quote from Dostoevsky blasting the pamphlet on Blackboard.
Yeah, it's pretty detailed in all the things that the pamphlet demands.
Yes.
But it's at the same time, is it really news? Isn't this all things that we've certainly heard over and over in our lifetime? So if we would say then, now we're looking at the idiot, if we can accept the interpretation of the idiot as that marriage of heaven and earth that was meant to happen for the future of Russia and then did not happen. And I refresh you on this, that in a sense, that Nastasya Filippovna, the object of desire, almost worship by so many, dazzling to so many, is set up by the novel as needing a husband. And the question is of who is capable of stepping forward. That obviously it would be the Prince Myshkin if he were not completely disqualified from his inner nature. And so that marriage of heaven and earth, of Nastasya Filippovna as Mother Russia, awaiting the fulfillment marriage that will actualize, that will actuate the entire culture. And with Myshkin, being as he is a kind of, you know, not quite knitted together bundle of ideals, you know, had he been someone who possessed those ideals confidently and realistically, had things gone in certain direction, such a marriage could have come about. In that sense, the idiot is then a story of a missed opportunity for Russia. That is a crucial missed opportunity. And that's followed then by this rushing in of demonic forces in the devils. That, in other words, it seems, and this, in this I'm going to rely on some privileged communication Dr. Louise Cowan, the real owner of this course, and her theory that we hope that we'll in fact get in print someday soon, is that Dostoevsky wrote a Divine Comedy in the three novels of his that we're reading in this course, and that the idiot, because of the unworthiness and the unsuitability of its main characters, is in a sense a portrait of an inferno. Right? In being such a missed opportunity, it is in fact an infernal comedy, one in which the failure is all cast upon human character and the human soul. Now the paradox is that the darker and darkest novel is the devils, right? The devastation that they work, but it's also about the purging of them, right? And they move on, right? And we look at the very end of this novel at the survivor, and so in a sense it is a purgatorial drama that takes place, and is a purgatorial comedy, right? As much as Dostoevsky is the heir of Aeschylus and Sophocles and Shakespeare, it's really not possible for his vision to include an exclusively tragic view. The novel has this full capability of rendering both the darkest moments of the human soul and also the escape from them. And I think that this is really would be the way to see this novel. The Brothers Karamazov, then, of course, it's although full of terrible things, also perhaps less of a difficult argument to say that a paradisal vision is enclosed in the brothers, and we'll be seeing that demonstrated, I think, before too long. Anyway, the analogy itself is vague, but I think it may be helpful. Certainly, it stresses the idea that Dostoevsky himself is on a journey as he writes these novels. Right. And it's rare, really, that happens, and that it happens successfully in the life of any artist, and especially in novelists who have to have a greater capacity for chaos than any other verbal artist. So Dostoevsky, in a sense, is working with the same problems from notes from Underground, Crime and Punishment, all the way through to his larger and greatest works. And we see this kind of evolution take place. The suggestion is that we're working within the universe of comedy from its darkest precincts to the most redemptive aspects within it. Now, one thing going on, of course, in the possessed, in the devils, is apocalypse as a dominant metaphor. And it seems really to be in almost every scene, right? The notion of the unveiling, of the end of things. There are many different notions for the apocalypse, but one certainly that perhaps most authoritative would be to call it the breaking in of the eternal upon time. And this certainly describes the kind of impact that these revolutionary moments, these destructive moments, have in this novel. So, now, for the reason of the fires in Petersburg and young Russia and so forth, and because of Dostoevsky's stated intent in his notes to his for his novel, The Devils was thought until recently to be primarily a political novel. Even a tract of Dostoevsky's that was written against socialism, against liberalism, for traditionalism, and so forth. And one of his translators said that spite and hatred toward his enemies characterizes the novel, and it would be absurd to take Dostoevsky's political views seriously. So this from a translator who translated the novel pretty well, you have to say. But we know that Karamazinov, is it, or Karamazinov? I forgot.
Karamazinov.
Is a caricature of Turgenev, but he's also certainly a fully functioning character in the novel. And when we read Dostoevsky's description of his way of thinking, right, that he's someone who wrote his most recent pieces with the idea that the reader, that he's saying to the reader, you know, you couldn't possibly appreciate this shipwreck as I could appreciate it. Simply marvel at the amazing impact that it has on my mind. He's speaking not to devastate one writer, but to characterize the very type of writers of whom I've met more than a few in my time. and so Dostoevsky himself claimed that his novel was tendentious. So the question is the flavor of the novel, and my suggestion is that it has some of that character of political satirical comedy in it, although the violence portrayed in it is quite terrible, right? And we know the story that it was based on a news item more recently, the murder of a student named Ivanov, led by a group of students, all tied together with the band leader, Nechayev, and so forth. So it has plenty of stimulus from the news of the time. But it is, at the same time, there are plenty of critics who have called this work unique in world literature. I'm taking the phrase from Konstantin Mochulsky, who is a good, reliable source for much of Dostoevsky's work. He attempts to write a book that covers all of his writings, and he doesn't do a bad job of a difficult, very difficult task. He said this sense was widespread at the time that Europe was on the eve of collapse. The loftiest human ideals were all going to be betrayed, and so forth. And of course, World War I and the simultaneous revolution in Russia were a proximate result of all those fears. So Dostoevsky started The Devils as a pamphlet novel, but it grew, and it grew along with the character of Stavrogin, who emerged during his writing as a totally new figure and changed the direction of his work to gain depth and to be more than a satire, to be rather one of his great works. And we see in it that Dostoevsky saw the city, the polis, as Plato did, as the soul, the human soul, writ large. And its drama is the drama of the human soul. Now, the focus of the novel, certainly, is Stepan and Varvara and the strange quasi-marriage that they have and out of whom come not quite incarnate way, the children who make up the real active forces of the novel. So Varvara, first syllable, and Stepan, who are terribly afraid of seeming provincial, who are best friends, although Varvara seems to have her way of keeping Stepan's subjugated, who love each other, you could say, as much as two self-centered persons in love. Remember that they went to the capital in search of being part of the moment, being part of history. It didn't work out so well and came back. Barbara has begun by pretending Stepan is a great writer. Stepan does his best to pretend this too until finally it caves in, and we have that memorable moment in which he says, je suis un dependent, or je suis un hanger-on, mais rien de plus. And really, after that moment, he is truly changed. If it's his fall, it's also his first moment of self-knowledge. He sort of lets himself go after that, drinks too much, gambles, stops reading, except for periodicals. If it were the age of the internet, I know exactly what he'd be doing. And has given up on that pretense of being a great writer, but he can still rise to pretenses from time to time. And the narrator of our novel is truly one of the creative forces of this novel, that he gradually becomes more involved in the action itself. We begin by simply thinking of him as a narrator off there in the distance at his writing desk, but we see how much he becomes, and actually he's struck at one point in the novel, and there are other ways in which he interacts more and more with the inevitable momentum of the rolling force of the novel. And this is really the genius of The Devils. You know, the narrator, who we also only gradually learn his name, and it's we learn it as G.V. For a long time, but then it's filled in, and it's Govorov. And my sparse Russian, I think, is enough to recognize a pun that is Govorit. And Govorit means he says, or he speaks, he talks. This man's name is Talker, right? It's just simply, or Speaker, as the case may be. But I like to think of him as more a garrulous type, and so Talker simply describes his need for existence. His tone is cast over the whole novel, and that is, There's always a slight bit of ridicule for everyone involved, including for himself. But he moves from being detached and ironic to stepping into the action and caring a great deal, as we know, about some of the characters. And that relation to Stepan is very interesting. My poor friend is a kind of refrain. He drinks vodka and champagne with him. perfectly critical of him, but we know that he has a soft spot in his heart for the man. Right. So, and if we look back at the early pages of the novel, Stepan with his poem, that wonderfully parodic poem of a Goethe-like in its nature, we see by the time we finish the novel that it is a kind of a summing up of the entire action of the novel. We read it in an apocalyptic vein. That beautiful young man whose name is Death and that everybody desires, that everybody awaits, is a foretelling of the action that will happen. That attempt to build the Tower of Babel that everybody will rejoice at and will chase off who's the fellow that they chase off? I can't remember. Some potentate, you know, again, is a way of seeing the form of the work to come. We can't realize it until we go back to reread it. So it's an ominous, and yet it's a comical foreshadowing of the folly, right, of the folly that human beings get involved in. And there is, of course, a longstanding way in which comedy can treat human folly. So Stepan and Varvara are the liberals of the 40s, and she is the figure of what Mother Russia has become. Right? She still has a big heart, right? And it's important for that, the way in which she wants to foster everything, but she is also cut off from the deepest aspects of life. Of course, Stepan himself is a reduced figure as well of the intellectual and spiritual tradition of Russia. Watered down, in his case, by European romanticism into something ineffectual and impotent. So these are two best friends who have let themselves be shallow through their vanity, through their wanting to be part of the times, wanting to be forward-looking, and so have deserted their real task for the generation to come. So in a sense, the real subject of this novel is education, right? Because of the bad education that these children have gotten. In Stepan, we see the type of the bad teacher. As sentimental, as full-hearted as he seems to be, he truly neglects his real task. He teaches them an idealism, mostly by example, right, that doesn't apply to reality. He teaches them a romantic ideal of classical beauty that is itself also not really applicable to reality. It's a beauty unattainable in life and damaging to the hearts and imaginations of those who take it up. If we go back and read about the early days of Stavrogin, we see this pattern, right? And we see this early on as he's an enlightened man, Stepan, is who just without any reservations, unburdens his heart to the young boy, right? And they spend many a night in tears together and so forth and so on, carrying on in this way. If don't know if you are reminded at that point of Prince Myshkin, who has said in his monologue about Marie that children can understand everything, and it's best to be perfectly honest. There's no reason to hold anything back from children. We all somehow are attracted to this kind of this moment. But Dostoevsky has an uncanny way of finding those motifs that we are tempted by and attracted by, and that turn out to be truly disastrous ideas. Because children, the children as portrayed here as Stavrogin and Pyotr, well, Stavrogin especially, come out completely unmoored with no real sense of anything being good or evil, indeed better or worse. And we see him when he's come back from some time away, and he's very reserved in his way of acting with Stepan. He doesn't interact with him anymore, holds himself back from him, because there's something kind of embarrassing about the entire way that he was brought up. And then as Stavrogin goes on into the army and so forth, we see somebody who truly has no moorings in a sense of right and wrong, a sense of honor and dishonor, and that it's quite possible that in the unleashing of all this true sentiment of Stepan, that he's let a view of life as unforgiving come out, of life as not measuring up at all to the dreams that Stepan has had, and in a sense removing the hope and the need for rigor, the need for self-discipline from his mind, from his life. So, that's, and we might look at a scheme that Rowan Williams suggests in his new book about Dostoevsky. That we have a typology of diabolical victories, right, in this first generation of Stepan, who, as he says, as William says, is perpetually self-deluded, with the two sons or stepsons of Stepan, Pyotr and Stavrogin, whom Williams characterizes as each embodying, characterizes both as having a special relation to power, in the sense that Pyotr, a brilliant and ruthless manipulator, takes as his priority always to maintain power over others. And there seems almost to be no other motivation in his acting. Whereas Stavrogin seems to always have power to others, the power of creating others, creating the illusions of others, creating the personalities even of others. Right. And he is remote and inscrutable and evades those who seek him. So we have, in a sense, in Pyotr and Stavrogin, the two sons, two radically different but in a sense complementary relations toward power. And that's the sons, and then comes the inner circle of this cell that is the endless subject of the novel, in Shatov and Kirillov and Shigalyov, all of whom are victims of or personifications of a single great idea, each idea a former view of Stavrogin, right? One that he no longer holds any responsibility for or responsibility toward, and each of them in their own way oriented toward death, ultimately. As we recall, we've talked about Shatov, and we've talked about Kirillov, and Kirillov has an attitude toward suicide that seems to remind, I think would strike notes of memory to anybody who has studied mysticism of any faith. Right. To me, he reminds me of some of the early comments about the discovery of Zen, the Zen branch of Buddhism, that discovery that there is no time, that the whole universe is made of glass, and at one stroke, we see it shattering down before him. There's an elation that follows upon that that is indescribable. so forth. You might hark back to an early moment in this course when we said that, made an enormous overgeneralization, and said that Russia has always had a fear of that it might be more Eastern than it knows. Right? That in a sense, would be a terrible thing, but it's always that is it a temptation or is it an emergence of a kind of Eastern mysticism that comes in from time to time? And for Dostoevsky, it seems quite a worrisome thing, although he gives a brilliant portrayal of it in the character of Kirillov. Rowan Williams says about him is that he represents the demonic aspect of visionary ecstasy. I think that's a pretty a concise way of saying it. He gives, I think, a very good discussion of Kirillov's point of view. And then there's Shigalyov, of course, with his Shigalyovism and his belief that the future can be planned and controlled and without compunction, says that a Cicero will have his tongue cut out, a Copernicus will have his eyes gouged out, a Shakespeare will be stoned, so that this utopian plan can be perfected. And we see Pyotr take all this down as in this grand meeting, as you were talking about, Scott. While has a way of making it now possible, right? Rather than these grand schemes that each of them talked of that seem to be existing only in theory, what Pyotr is mostly interested in is making it happen, making something happen, right? And getting that commitment from people to go ahead and sign their souls over to violence. So with that whole arc of characters in Pyotr to these three main characters of the inner circle. You see the golden age gradually become the path to hell. Now, one more remark to make about Shatov and Kirillov is that they both live on, can I say this? Bogoyavlenskaya Street. Sorry. Yeah, this is a street whose name means epiphany or revelation. Again, for your nickel and dime study of Russian, Bog means God. So that at least gives us a start on this long word. There is an aspect of theirs, of their kind of visionary political views or theory that orients them toward something divine, but it's incompletely realized and really in a very flawed way realized. And Rowan Williams' final remark on the group is, and on this entire typology of diabolical victories, is he says the devil, who is the enemy of any real freedom, is shown offering a variety of ersatz freedoms, leading to death. I think that's a good way of summing that. Shatov and Kirillov were together in America, or in a sense represented by that scene, by that motif that goes on, is that they were kind of the parts of a single whole. And what animates them is ideas that they got from Stavrogin. Stavrogin, who is above all that and beyond all that, is out there facing the void, a Byronic hero, very much something that comes out of Romanticism, but that is not viewed as an angel with his wings clipped like Prince Myshkin, but rather as a dark angel, as someone who has been ruined by his teacher and turned into a dark romantic idealist. He's searching for a burden. And so as with the Byronic hero, there is a heroic aspect of Stavrogin. And we don't do wrong to stress that heroic side, not so much in the reality, but in what perhaps his figure is called to be, that he is, in a sense, called to be a deliverer figure of Russia, a hero figure. But his denial of that is immense. And and the way that he injures himself in the outrages that he commits seem to be almost inescapable, as we find out in the chapter at the monk Tihon's. And as he asks the monk, he says, "Can one believe in the devil without believing in God?" Because he senses the devil as a very intimate force. And there are times, he says, in which he senses someone else right at his side, right, a dark presence right at his side. And so he knows, Tihon knows, that the struggle of this young man is genuine, but that it is, you know, indeed that he has a lot to struggle with. This intense dialogue at the monk's cell is perhaps the heart of the novel. If we place it at that moment after the diabolical conspiracy of Pyotr has been formed, and Stavrogin then goes off to ask at that moment, this indeed makes it the center of the novel. Now, again, Machulsky tells us something more, a good deal more, if you go and look at it, about what Dostoevsky wanted to do with his novel. And now that we have the notebooks in translation, we can see this full struggle. Again, it's something not to get into, really, unless you really want to study Dostoevsky at an advanced level. But there is an amazing dynamic at work in the creative process of Dostoevsky. Machulsky summarizes, and he said that really, ultimately, he had planned to have Stavrogin be delivered and saved, so that too was going to reach that turning point and go on. And the rough drafts reveal his desperate fight to do this, right, and his defeat. So again, how is it possible we have to change our notion of fiction for the great novelists? They are not manipulating characters out of something that they would like to do. They are being manipulated by those characters. They become, through fidelity to certainly something that comes to them, right, the servant of that thing, whatever it may be. W.K. Wimsatt once wrote in a little essay on organic form that the poem makes itself out of itself. And I think the same is true. We see that very clearly in Dostoevsky's struggle with even a gigantic novel, that this can be the case. It is, in a sense, self-organizing. The writer submits himself to his idea, and this is the idea that Henry James later called his donné, right, his given. And doesn't really know quite what it is or what it must become. It's possible that it will surprise him utterly. It's possible that it will disillusion his hopes. And this is that need for unfolding that is something that Dostoevsky has commented about and that he exemplifies in his notebooks as we see development of these novels. But Machulsky is confident and calls The Devils one of the greatest artistic works in world literature. So he's clear and not in saying that this was an unsuccessful novel because the novelist couldn't wrestle his material in the direction he wanted to take it in, but rather this is one of the greatest artistic works. Right. In it, everything is in motion constantly. We hear a polyphony of voices and the heights and depths to which he goes here may be greater than in any other of Dostoevsky's novels. At the end of this novel, as I'm suggesting, the devils are purged, and you will see a changed tone, if you haven't already begun to, in The Brothers Karamazov, one that I think is not necessarily explained by some idea of how Dostoevsky changes, but that is quite notable nonetheless. And it's interesting in that you have novels written, although they're written over many, many years, written in quick succession, which he's no sooner finishes one than he turns to another, and in each case the narrator is utterly metamorphosed. He's not the same kind of narrator at all. In Crime and Punishment, there is no narrator with a personality. It's just trying to get out of the way of the action and of the thoughts and feelings and dreams of the character and just present them as effectively as possible. And the idea of a narrator as having a personality reaches its peak in The Possessed. Of course, there's been our first person narrator in Notes from Underground, right? But that's telling one point of view. He is by no means a narrator who's carrying on with a vast array of characters. Now, how is it that our narrator can do that? How is it he is no longer, Dostoevsky has to desert the idea of an omniscient narrator or of being somebody with a plug into the mind of some character and instead rely on rumor, rely on saying, I was there, this happened, I wasn't there, but they were talking all about it in town and so forth. And so he relies on what he has to set up as a supposed human network that already exists and that he's giving form to in his own narrative. So it's a brilliant advance in the art of narration. Machulsky again says that Stavrogin is Dostoevsky's greatest artistic creation. I'm just saying all this to challenge all of you all the time. And also to say, hey, consider writing about this novel. You won't find any paucity of material to write about if you want to write about the devils. There is certainly with Stavrogin savior imagery as well as antichrist imagery. And in a novel that talks openly about the man-god, right, about replacing the god-man with the man-god, he is someone that is looked to as to a messiah figure. And that remarkable scene in which Pyotr comes and tries to win Stavrogin over and says, you're my idol, you're beautiful to me. Everything that I do is basically for you. An amazing scene. And Stavrogin is understandably turned off by this, but we see this dynamic of him, rejecting Pyotr, who comes at him with a naked worship. It's because when Pyotr sees what Stavrogin is, right, he realizes that his own power could be unlimited. as he says, right, the, when an aristocrat goes for democracy, there's just no, you know, no stopping what can happen. Right. And Stavrogin is not simply putting off Pyotr because that's the way he maintains his power, right? No, it's because he is genuinely troubled by the evil that he sees in Pyotr, and he's genuinely put off by it. And this is why he goes then to see Tichon. Right. Now, the portrait of Tichon, right, is meant as a portrait of Russian monasticism. So we get some of those descriptions of his room as full of books and liquor, and there might, you know, might be some very popular book, and it's, and he puts in quotation marks, and some have said some, and some have said there might be something much worse, and so forth. So we enter him with a if we have a need for a really otherworldly holy man, we're going to be disillusioned at this point, and we might even be put off by Tichon. But know that the goal of Dostoevsky in both The Idiot and the Possessed is a need for incarnation. And if we have a monk who is really living this life, then hey, you know, he's going to be incarnate. And he's not going to exist in order to fulfill our fantasies that are disincarnate things. I think the proof of the pudding, you know, is in the tasting of it. And it's the how he responds to this terrible case of Stavrogin and what he says to him. And we have to look at him in that way. And he knows that Stavrogin is a soul that is on the needle point. You know, he can go either way. And he treats him in that way. And his parting invocation to him is, you know, come back to the monastery. You know, go and give yourself to, he said, not to religious orders altogether, but to a religious life. So his admonition to Stavrogin does not pull any punches. And by that time, Stavrogin is, of course, is his last line as he leaves, is cursed psychologist. Right, that there's somebody who thinks he can see into me, and he's using monkish tricks, right? And yet he knows. He's been touched. He's been reached by Tichon. So that's a very, very telling scene, and one that we have to look at carefully. All right. How are we doing? Okay. Questions? Comments? I think I've run out of main things to say. Yes.
How much does Nietzsche draw from Dostoevsky?
What
was the effect of Dostoevsky on Nietzsche?
Well, once again, you know, Nietzsche completely rejected Christianity. Well, not just rejected it, but thought it was the worst thing that had ever happened. And so, given that, you know, still to say that he thinks that Dostoevsky was the best psychologist he's ever read is pretty good. But Nietzsche did not spend much of his time thinking about things that he had read. In other words, I think he generally misinterpreted, as far as I know. I mean, I'm not a scholar of Nietzsche, but he misinterpreted Euripides. He misinterpreted Hegel, and misinterpreted Dostoevsky. And those are only the authors that I know about. You know, so his brilliance is in his own thoughts. And so, you know, that's, take all that into account when you start thinking about Nietzsche and Dostoevsky.
Uh-huh. I wanted to ask you about the idea that it's a purgative kind of effect when the devils leave. I mean, that they're gone at the end, I think we have to say, but is it more that it's a self-destructive behavior? Because, I mean, Stavrogin, you could say that his suicide is a form of his purgative, but at the same time, when he leaves Tichon, he says, "You're going to see, you're contemplating the ultimate act of rebellion." And then he goes and is at least implicated in two more murders and responsible for all of this destruction. So I'm not convinced that it's purgative so much as it's a self-destructive like the devil's, this evil is self-destructive necessarily.
Well, you have to ask what's being purged.
Yeah.
So if it's the city, you see, the community is being purged, not the individuals.
But has it been purged, or has the evil just destroyed itself?
Well, how else do you purge evil?
He doesn't happen to have a flaming sword at hand. But no, but I mean, I think part of the motive for the suicide is to keep, you know, evil from being utterly triumphant, because he sees how he is being conscripted into all those plans to do it. And so that marks, I think, part of it. And it has to be taken into account. Angela.
And that would go with the epigraph, the self-destructive evil, because that's the whole point, is that the devil pigs are throwing themselves over the cliff and drowning themselves in the ocean.
That's right, that's right.
So if we're supposed to move sort of from a purgatory to a paradiso, then what's supposed to be fruitful at the end of this novel? Where's the grounds for life when, most of the main characters are dead.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, look at the epigraph. You're bringing up an excellent point. It's one that I haven't addressed. But go back to the epigraph. I don't know what to make of the Pushkin epigraph. It's also very descriptive. But when he uses the Bible, and he has not used the scripture as an epigraph before, I don't think. And it was the episode of the Gadarene swine. The devils went out of the man and entered into the swine. Right? And then they went out to see what was done, says my translation, and came to Jesus and found the man, out of whom the devils were departed, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Who is that man, out of whom the devils have gone? It's Stepan, who has really been purged of his romantic tendencies, and remains a holy fool of a sort, right? But he has really embraced love, right? And so we see him rescued from this whole, and that moment where Lisa meets him. It's such a beautiful thing. And they're outside the city. They have a view of the city, right? The destruction of the city. And that meeting between them is a blessing that is so crucial for the end of the novel to take place, even though Lisa then is killed terribly and everything else bad happens.
I think we probably have to end. But I was just going to say, you notice there's Stepan, who is the real holy fool, ultimately, is the false holy fool that they visit before the celebration. But also there is that conflict in the piano piece that Liamshin plays, where Liber Augustine overcomes the Marseillaise. And, you know, if you look at, go on Google Du Liber Augustine, because there's a translation in the Wikipedia entry, and read that translation, because when the narrator refers to Verhovensky as my poor dear friend, see, Auch du lieber Augustin could be translated as, oh poor friend, oh poor dear Augustine. And it's catastrophic. It talks about the good times are replaced by plague. The whole song is
Alles ist teen.
They
say as they drink. Right? Yeah. It's a drinking song. But it's a typical drinking song. You can say all kinds of terrible things, terrible fortune, and you're saying it in a mode of rejoicing, right? Excellent idea. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Even that rich town Vienna broke his like Augustine. Shed tears with coffee can, all is lost. Oh, this, that seemed to be independent.